Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, April 24th. I'm Ray Graff. The National Center for Education Statistics says as of 2013, the total outstanding student loan debt in the U.S. had reached $1.2 trillion. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says it jumped to $1.46 trillion in 2018. Here to discuss this and much more are three experts. Patty Thompson is the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Student Financial Aid Services at the State University of New York. Jerry Englert is the Director of Education Advisory Services for M&T Bank. And Elizabeth Pop-Berman is a professor at the University at Albany who specializes in economic sociology and higher education. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we discuss student loan debt. The National Center for Education Statistics says as of 2013, total outstanding student loan debt in the U.S. had reached $1.2 trillion. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says that number jumped to $1.46 trillion in 2018. Here to discuss the cost of higher education, three experts today. Patty Thompson is the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Student Financial Aid Services at the State University of New York. Jerry Englert is the Director of Education Advisory Services for M&T Bank. And Elizabeth Pop-Berman is a professor at the University at Albany who specializes in economic sociology and higher education. If you have a question, this is a weighty topic, and it's on many a parent's mind. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Patty, Elizabeth, and Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Where to begin? Where to begin? Well, let's start with Elizabeth, who is a professor at UAlbany and specializing in sort of the background and the sociology of this. $1.46 trillion is an unfathomable amount of
money. It's an enormous number.
How did we get to this point?
It was a very long and incremental process. Nobody ever would have designed the system that we've got now if somebody was going to set out to create one from start. But we started making government loans all the way back in the 1950s. You know, it really grew very incrementally up until the 1990s. And then there was a point at which the pace of borrowing really started to accelerate. So you sort of have universities and colleges rising tuition happening hand in hand with the government making more loans available. And you sort of get this this cycle where borrowing just ramps up. And so over the last 10, 20 years, you just see this enormous takeoff. And so we've got a system that's very complex. It's very difficult to navigate. And again, not a system that anybody would have chosen to set up this way if you were going to do it from scratch.
The prime culprit in your research is rising tuition rates, or is that much too simple an answer?
I think that's too simple an answer. I mean, I think certainly rising tuition rates are contributing to this, but I would not point to student loans as being the primary cause of rising tuition rates. But to the extent that tuition rates do rise, obviously, if people are able to borrow, people really feel like they want to go to college, they need to go to college in order to be economically successful, and they're going to find a way to do that. And they will, you know, in many cases, borrow as much as they need in order to do that.
Patty Thompson, is it worth it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the big things with student loans is it speaks to access, right? We want to make sure that everybody who wants to go to college has the ability and has access to the funds to do so. We certainly see that there's no change in the amount of increase in your income that you'll see if you do have a college degree. And that would obviously vary based on whether you have an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree or an advanced degree. But year after year, we see that there is still this very important piece, which is it does pay off. However, one of the big things for all of us, I think, to remember is it pays off for those who complete, mostly, right?
Right.
You have to stay. You have to stick it out. And one of the things that we are very happy about at SUNY is all of the efforts to help our students to stay in school and complete. Because with student loan borrowing, once you've made that commitment and you've borrowed any amount to go to college. It might seem daunting to some students to say, well, at this point, I've already borrowed a couple thousand dollars a year. I'm done, right? Mm. The most important piece of that is you've made that commitment, and financially, it's really best for you to stay in and get across that finish line.
Jerry Englert, for a student entering in the fall of 2019, assuming a four-year degree, what will the average debt load be for that student?
Well, that's an interesting question, because for the student, the maximum that they're able to take out is about $31,000 in federal loans. The challenge here is that the parents sometimes come into play with the parent plus loans. And that is why that's a bit of a deceiving figure, $31,000. They say, well, that's reasonable. But that doesn't always account for private sector loans, parent loans, and a couple other things. Just one more fact related to that $1.5 trillion piece I wanted to make sure people were aware of. When you look at the federal government's balance sheet, on the liability side, we know we have a little over $20 trillion of debt. On the asset side, the federal government has $2.8 trillion. So 43.9% of the federal government's assets are positioned in federal student loans, and we have delinquency rates of 11.5%. That should be alarming.
So 11%, to put this in perspective with the average borrower, not a non-education loan, what's the average default rate on a non-education loan?
It's much lower than that. It is the highest sector of default and delinquency. I mean, we're looking at, on the private sector side of the student loans, we're looking at anywhere from 2 to 3%. Mm. For as a banker, you know, we like to see delinquencies anywhere from 2 to 4%. So when we start getting into double digits, that is a symptom that the current circumstance is not sustainable.
Okay, it's a symptom that the current circumstance is not sustainable. Is this primarily because there are kids who say, I got to go to school, but they're not ready for school, and they ultimately don't want to go to college. You.
Well, coming from my standpoint, I think there's a lot of things that go into the decision about where to go to school, how much of a commitment you want to make financially. From a SUNY perspective, we have every configuration possible of students, from our very traditional to our non-traditional, our students who live in dorms, those who commute. So we have a little bit of everything, you know, every option available to students. So what we really see is not necessarily people what we say is don't throw away the whole situation if maybe what you're involved in currently isn't exactly what you thought it was going to be. So, for example, if a student goes away and lives in a dorm and then decides it's not for them, don't throw away college. You've made a commitment. Look into other options. Maybe going to a commuter campus closer to home would be a good option for you. Because the other thing that we know is very important is, again, once a student makes that commitment, we don't want them to backtrack and say it wasn't worth it and then get into a situation where they're going to try to repay a student loan on a much smaller income than what they would have actually earned if they completed their degree. And what we know, too, from our standpoint is students who go into a delinquent or default status, unfortunately, are often students who don't take action to make sure that they're aware of what their rights and responsibilities are as a student loan borrower. And there are many, many rights that they have, which would be different types of repayment plans and different options. So what we always counsel our students is to empower yourself, be in the driver's seat, so that if you find yourself in a situation where you might be at a campus that isn't working out for you, or if you're in a program of study that you're thinking maybe not exactly what you thought it was going to be, don't give up. Work with the folks at your campus to make it worthwhile for you and to change if you need to. But don't just stop. And also, most importantly for student loans, Jerry's absolutely right. We're looking at, across the nation, you know, these increases in the number of students who are delinquent. And we absolutely at SUNY are very sensitive to that, given the cost of tuition at SUNY being so reasonable and the costs that are involved in going to any college they increase. You know, it's expensive to live in the dorms across New York State. Regardless of where you live, there's a cost associated with that. There's a cost of food. Most importantly, though, what we work with our students to do is to provide services to say you don't have to give up. You can make wise decisions based on your situation and ultimately get across that finish line.
Patty Thompson is here from the State University of New York. Jerry Englert is here from M&T Bank. And Elizabeth Pop Berman of UAlbany. We are discussing student debt today, higher education debt. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. Let's take a call or two before the first break. Cliff in Poughkeepsie. Cliff, you're on.
Hi, how's it going today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So, full disclosure here, I think that I'm going to reveal that I don't know much about the subject.
All right.
But, excuse me. I was wondering if you could talk about if there's any kind of correlation between the rise in tuition costs and basically the federal government's involvement. Like, I don't even remember where I heard it, but once these loans were guaranteed and the colleges knew they were going to get money, they said, oh, this is great. We could charge pretty much whatever we want.
Well, I'm
so
sure.
I know it's probably, that's a little far-fetched, but I don't even remember where I heard it, but I wonder if you could talk about that.
All right, I'm sure our entire panel wants to weigh in on this. Let's start with Elizabeth Pop Berman.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. Researchers talk about that. It's called the Bennett hypothesis. It was originally named after William Bennett, was Secretary of Education under President Reagan, and he sort of proposed this idea. And there's been a lot of research trying to evaluate that because it seems like it makes a lot of sense. You know, the results are a little bit mixed. The best evidence that I've seen finds that there is some relationship between how much aid is available and the price of tuition, particularly in the for-profit sector. It's much less of a relationship, you know, very little in the not-for-profit and public sector. And there's even been very recently, actually just saw this in the last day or two, new research that's come out looking at loan availability and attendance in medical and law schools where there's more flexibility often about raising tuition. And again, you know, sometimes they find a little bit of relationship, like it's maybe driving 10% of the price increases, but it's not the big factor in terms of what's going on as plausible as it seems.
Jerry Englert.
Yeah, the research is mixed. My intuition tells me William Bennett's correct. And and obviously my intuition doesn't really mean much. But the reason I've studied this, I've actually completed a Granger causality regression model testing the Bennett hypothesis. And I found in general there was some evidence that this is the case. I mean, if you have the ability to borrow, obviously it's not a perfect market when we have guaranteed loans. I would love to see a study that actually witnessed a lowering of loan limits to see if that would lower the cost of college. I think that would be very interesting. But nonetheless, the research out there does have its mixed review. So we don't know for certain if William Bennett is correct.
Patty Thompson, before we take a break.
Well, you know, I just think, you know, coming from SUNY, these are conversations about, you know, what impacts costs and what impacts increases. At SUNY, you know, our tuition is not determined based on those factors. Obviously, our legislature determines, you know, where we can actually increase our tuition. So I would point to other costs that are associated with educational costs also that have to be discussed as part of this conversation because, you know, there are so many other costs that go into the amount that a student really faces when they're deciding where they're going to go to school. So you're again, just going back to, you know, am I going to live in a dorm or am I going to buy a certain meal plan? There's costs associated that also determine student loan eligibility, and those would be the cost of textbooks, the cost of food, you know, any kind of supplies or personal costs that would be associated also.
Let's take a quick break here. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. Student debt today on the program. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. Elizabeth Pop Berman is a professor at the University at Albany who specializes in economic sociology and higher education. Jerry Englert is the director of education advisory services for M&T Bank. And Patty Thompson is assistant vice chancellor of student financial aid services at the State University of New York. We are discussing today higher education debt And the phone lines are loading up here. Still a few open ones if you want to get in. 800-348-2551. Jim in Albany. Jim, you're on.
Hey, hello, Ray.
Hello.
Thanks for the great program. One of your panelists said that the student debt started to skyrocket in the 1990s, and I was just wondering, when in the 1990s, was it the middle of the 1990s by any chance?
Well, I would say actually the skyrocketing was more after 2000. There were policy changes in the 1990s that kind of started it, but it was sort of gradual acceleration and then really took off after 2000.
When did the policy changes? You said they were 1990s. Was that middle or late?
Very early 90s. Very early 90s. And some of the changes were...
Speaker of the House?
I'm sorry? I think it was before Gingrich was elected.
Took over Speaker of the House?
It was prior to Gingrich.
So who
I believe it was under the Clinton administration.
The policy changes?
I believe it was under the Clinton administration, and you had changes that that allowed you to that increased the ability of parents to borrow and allowed students to took off the cap so that a lot more people could borrow unsubsidized loans at the federal level, and that kind of created the conditions for the expansion.
Who was the architect of the policy changes? Do we know?
I'm sorry?
The architect of the policy changes.
Who was the architect of the policy changes? Do we know?
The architects were pretty much people coming from the higher education sector and from the banking sector, both of whom were collectively interested in providing more access on the one hand and then also in ensuring there was sort of enough federal support for loans on the other.
Jerry England.
Yes, thank you. This is vital information. Thank you very much.
So some of this is a factor of the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which happens approximately every 10 years where these policies are discussed. So there's multiple people that can be involved in this process.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Patty, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just thinking about also the amount of debt that students take on. And I think that one of the big things is students do, again, they need to be aware. One of the things that I think is most important is reaching students at an early enough time frame for them to make, very wise decisions about what kind of commitment they want to make for their education as far as financing. And what we see at SUNY is we have an average debt at graduation that's much lower than, what you see in other parts of New York State and across the nation. We're proud of that, but that has come from a lot of working with our students, providing services. Chancellor Johnson has really promoted with us a Smart Track campaign that helps us to really make information available consistently to our students across the system, and we're really pleased with that because our outcomes are, we're seeing that students are not borrowing as much. We're also seeing that our default rates are definitely decreased. We have more students who are successful repayments than we ever have over the last few years, and we're very happy about that. And what that says to us, too, that education is a very big component in this, and that's a very important piece.
The number is 800-348-2551, and let's jump back on the phones here. Sally in Durham. Sally, you're on.
Hi, yes, this is Sally. I have a question regarding private student loans. My son has a great amount of private student loans, and when he first started making repayments on them, I pleaded with the bank to allow him to do it over more than 10 years, and I quickly discovered that wasn't allowed. So I ended up having to take the debt into my name, a big chunk of the debt, and I was able to get it over 15 years. I'm just wondering if your guests know anything as to whether it will be likely that these interest rates on the private loans will go down to more like a mortgage rate, and whether they will see that it might be a possibility for students to pay it over 20 years, 25 years instead of 10.
Jerry.
And I'll take my answer offline. Okay,
thanks a lot.
Wonderful. So one of the most important pieces that I stress with parents and students as they're signing private student loans is to really review the terms. Traditionally, the terms are locked in at the time with which you sign them. What makes it difficult is these are a lot of times electronic signatures with a lot of language. So you want to make sure you know the term. Also, many times parents don't realize they've taken out a variable interest rate. The federal loans are only fixed. Private student loans could be variable or fixed. There are certain lenders that will allow terms that are longer than 10 years, but most default to 10 years. Very rarely do you get beyond a 20-year term on a private student loan. So that's just something to be aware of. You can't possibly always refinance the private student loans, And it's, of course, market-driven. So if the rates dip, you want to pay attention to that. Whereas with federal student loans, you have the ability to consolidate them, but you don't have the opportunity to effectuate any change in the interest rate. They might take a blended interest rate. So it's just, I guess, best practice here is to know what the term is going in, and there are some lenders that will allow you to go beyond 10 years.
All right. Number here is 800-348-2551. Jerry England is here, Elizabeth Pop Berman, and Patty Thompson. Let's go to Teresa in Taconic. Teresa, you're on.
Hi. I have more of a comment than a question. I'll explain first that I'm 66 years old. I began school in 1978, got a bachelor's degree, didn't get much debt then, a little bit, not much. Went under the Veterans Orphans Act. We were very, very poor. Then I went to two master's programs, graduated from all of these things, got a lot of debt in the master's programs. Tried to get work with the first master's, but I had to jump back in school, partly because of the student debt. I couldn't make payments and couldn't find work that was adequate. So anyway, I came out with about with much more debt than I could pay. I had to delay payment while I got my earnings up to a sufficient amount to make payments. I began making steady payments. And $169,000 I will be paying out of my Social Security. You know, got to retire. I can't work forever. And what really killed me, I think, I'm making payments monthly, and all of it went to interest. Not any of it went to principal, and I'm still mad about it. I wrote to all my legislatures. I tried to deal with the Department of Education. I'm consolidated with Fed student loans, and I'm just upset about the whole damn thing. I have a suggestion. Why don't we calculate how much people have paid on their student loans in total as we look at the big picture as they continue? Because my debt didn't go down.
Okay. Anybody
pardon
here?
Pardon me if I sound kind of frustrated.
No, I get it, Teresa.
That's all. Thank
sure. Anybody on the panel want to weigh in on this?
I would be willing to. So the challenge here is that when you're in deferment or forbearance, interest can accrue depending on the loan, and many times that's what happens. So you have interest while you're in these deferment or forbearance period that are capitalizing on top of the loan. If the caller has federal loans, she potentially could look into a possibility of an income-driven repayment, might be a possibility. There's also, for federal loans, there's an ombudsman, if she looks on studentaid.gov, that could possibly help if this was miscalculated.
Patty.
I was just going to add to that, you know, when we are advising students, you know, at all of our campuses, we make sure that we have conversations with them about, you know, how much they're borrowing and what their rates and responsibilities are as student loan borrowers. Because as Jerry said, you really have to be aware when you're going into this, what type of loan you're agreeing to signing for, because in most cases, your best bet is to go with federal loans first. We do see that at some of our, you know, some of our institutions where you're working on graduate degrees, you know, if someone's working on their doctorate or anything that's, you know, an advanced degree, they will tend to be borrowing more. You know, you will tend to see that. So in those situations, we see it's actually a very small percentage of students who across the nation who really borrow six figures. I know that's generally what you hear, and that tends to be something that's a little bit more newsworthy. I guess that there's a lot of students in that category, when in reality it's actually kind of a small number. But it's always the same advice, is to go back, look for resources that can help you to make the right decision based on what you're studying and what your goals are ultimately.
And if I could just add something to that, on that unfortunately isn't very helpful on the individual side, but kind of on the policy side, student loans are really distinctive in that they're not bankruptable, which is, you know, very unusual among types of debt. And so, you know, that's been a policy that's been in a place for a very long time. But because of that, if you find yourself either because you've made some financial decisions that you regret, or you've had life circumstances that have allowed them not to pay off, you can't walk away. Right.
One other piece to what the caller had to say was, of the $1.5 trillion of federal debt, one-third of it is held by people in advance of the age of 40.
You know, it occurs to me, and I'm sorry if I seem cynical, and we'll jump back on the phones in a moment. Most kids who are 17, 18 years old really don't have a clue about too much. How then does Patty Thompson explain to the 17 or 18, and I apologize, I have children, and so I apologize to everyone. How do you explain to them that, hey, this is for real, you're borrowing a lot of money,
right.
And at 17, 18, a lot of kids, they don't even know what they want to do. They don't know if it's a good fit. How, in fact, how do you do full disclosure when full disclosure would take 9 weeks?
Exactly. Well, it's a challenge. I mean, we have we use a lot of electronic resources to really reach our students. And as you know, we serve, you know, our demographic reaches all edges of New York State. We have a Smart Track campaign that involves financial literacy, and we provide that to students beginning in high school, right? So we have online tools as well as face-to-face guidance. We do a significant amount of training, not just in the high school level, but we go as deep as we can into schools to say, you need to be thinking about it and to be keeping your mind on what your ultimate goal is, because your typical traditional student tends to live in the moment.
Yeah.
So what we find is that we need to have tools that sort of cut across all of that and say, okay, we have tools, for example, this demographic that you're specifically talking about, they like to do things online, and tools that need to be available to them 24/7. So instead of maybe setting up a face-to-face visit for them to listen to someone lecture them about financial literacy, we have tools that reach them. And the tools are very comprehensive. They talk about the actual cost of things. So for example, if you're buying a cup of coffee every day, a latte, that's $5, what does it really cost you? Actual cost, meaning taxes, like how long do you have to work in order to pay for that? What we find is that we have a great reaction to all of those types of, you know, informational pieces that are available to our students. They respond to coursework that's very brief, you know, informational tools that are on our websites, because we can't always do it face to face. And unfortunately, these are students who are making really big decisions and maybe don't have the right information in front of them at the time. So we strive continually to say, okay, what else can we do to reach them? And we have these tenets of financial literacy and making smart decisions to say, get in the driver's seat, ask questions, know how much you're borrowing, know what your rights and responsibilities are, monitor it every year. That's the other piece that's important to a young group of students, to say, you don't just do it once and then walk away. It's
right.
Continual monitoring.
See, I don't want to cast aspersions on all 17 and 18 year olds, but is it possible that the entire system needs some revision, Elizabeth? When kids, I mean, I'm only speaking from experience.
I've got a 14 year old. Right there with you.
Okay, you know, they don't even want to make that decision.
Right.
So how do you get through to them?
I mean, I think that one place that there's a lot of room for simplification is in the FAFSA itself, the forms that you have to fill out in order to apply for financial aid, which are just very complex, very difficult for people to manage. If you are, particularly if you're a first-generation student and you don't have parents who have already been through this and who can help you with it, you know, trying to figure this out on your own at age 17 or 18 is just really difficult. And there has been some research that's shown that if we went to what's called a prior year model, where you just use basically people's income tax returns from 2 years ago so they can't try to game the system too easily, you get, you know, 98% of the same results, but you just simplify the process enormously. And I think there's a lot of room for doing things like that that would have an impact on a lot of people.
Jerry, go ahead.
You know, parents just have to say no. You can't stop parenting at 18. and really, they're going from prom dresses and prom tuxes up to sometimes six-figure decisions, which are pretty significant. So when I work with my clients, as freshmen and sophomores in high school, we will grab the net price calculators of the colleges in question. Every college is required to have a net price calculator, which allows a parent to punch in their income, their assets. They're close. They're not perfect. They're estimates. And to begin to have a conversation as to what will work for the family. So it's not just an academic fit, a social fit, but it is a financial fit for the family, because the best thing a parent could be for their child is financially independent. And so having these conversations as a freshman and sophomore about the outer limits of finances versus having them in April of senior year when they get disappointed, those are two different ways to approach it. My suggestion is to have this discussion very early.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's take another call here before we take a break, and we'll go to Vanessa in Williamstown. Vanessa.
Hi. I just have a couple of comments. One is that it seems to me that if the feds are concerned about their balance sheet and they are willing to lend money to banks at a certain Fed rate, why is it not possible to have that rate be the same for student loans? And would that decrease the default rate? That's part one. And part two is if this is really about access, it seems to me that there needs to be a different kind of funding revenue stream to support kids that are interested in going to college.
All right. First part first.
It's possible to subsidize any interest rate. So is it possible? Certainly. I mean, there are costs to administer this program that are there are not, you know, they have to account for those costs. And I think when you look at the interest rates that the federal loans provide, they set them approximately every June. They're close to market rates. So my argument would be that they should be allowed to refinance those when market rates are down. And that's something that doesn't exist today. With federal loans, that is.
All right. Part two, Vanessa.
I would agree with that.
And then part two of your question, very quickly, we have to take a break here.
Well, I just think that it would be helpful to have more revenue streams coming into whatever supports both financial aid and these loans. You know, for some schools, it's taking money directly out of gross tuition dollars, which means that it's money that the school simply never gets. And for others, it's coming out of endowment, and they have plenty of it.
Okay.
And I just think that it would be nice to have more alternative revenue streams.
Well, this sounds like something Patty Thompson could comment on briefly before we take a break here. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, yeah, we definitely have I think it's – in New York State, it's kind of a – we have a different – I would say it's a little bit of a different concern for us. And I think certainly when we look at, you know, funding streams or the way our campuses operate would be a little bit different. And I would also say that New York State in itself is actually provides other opportunities for financing education because we have a very robust tuition assistance program with just the tuition assistance program alone, 55% of students who attend SUNY and CUNY are attending tuition-free. But we're not talking about, you know, I realize that when we start talking about revenue streams, we start talking about where money comes from, and it's complex. I would also say, though, that we've seen some huge inroads in New York State also with the Excelsior Scholarship, which our governor, you know, enacted. We're going into year three with Excelsior, and Governor Cuomo's been very supportive in looking at how we can, you know, get around some of these costs and how we can assist our students in other ways.
We have to take a quick break here. Patty Thompson, Jerry Englert, and Elizabeth Pop Berman are with us. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Numbers 800-348-2551. Elizabeth Pop Berman, Jerry Englert, and Patty Thompson here to answer your questions today about student debt. And gang, we have three emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from Scott, came in via Twitter, and Scott wonders how student loan interest rates got so high. When Scott attended in the 70s, he was paying 2%, and that's when interest rates were high overall. He just paid off his son's loans. Federal loan was 8%. No other long-term loan, mortgages, car loans are that high. What's up with that?
Well, previously they were subsidized a bit more. They're more market-driven now. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not sure how else to characterize it other than there's a discussion of the costs and what the current market conditions reveal.
Okay.
And that's how they're set.
This one is from Christine in Waterville. Is there any discussion of addressing financial issues in elementary school with parents and to some extent students as a follow-up to my concerns?
Yeah. Well, I know from, you know, from a SUNY standpoint, is we take every opportunity that we can to get into schools to talk as early as possible with students. And we have a website that is specifically for high school students, and we encourage any area where anybody is asking or looking for assistance to reach out to us, from the, whether it's a PTA or Cub Scouts or whatever. We have a variety of those kinds of events that go on a regular basis from our campuses.
I would also just add that you know, that I teach undergraduates a class in higher education. They often really wish they had even some exposure in high school that they're really not necessarily, unless you happen to be at a school where you're lucky enough to get access to this. A lot of people don't have any exposure at all by the time that they're actually applying.
You know, Elizabeth, have you done any study, or has anyone ever done any study about the rate of student loan defaults for those who have waited a year for the first year?
I actually don't know of any research that's been done that has looked at people who have waited a year. I mean, the big risk for default is if you don't finish, right? And it's not the people who are borrowing the most money. It's the people who go for three semesters, don't continue for one reason or another, and then, you know, they're making $11 an hour and they can't pay off that $10,000
right.
that they borrowed.
And this gets to my point about maturity, and that sometimes you wait a year, the difference between being 18 and 19, it's pretty huge.
Yeah, no, I think it's certainly possible that would make a difference for some students. Although one thing I think is just worth remembering is that, you know, 40% of college students right now are over the age of 25. So when we have this image of college students being 17, 18 and starting for the first time, it also really doesn't capture the full population of who's actually borrowing.
Jerry.
One other item on the gap year. If they use the gap year to work, that will hurt their financial aid. So it's another disincentive.
Okay, now isn't this a part of the problem as well?
Sorry.
All right, final email, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Mark. Mark writes, there are many elderly people who tell stories about how cheap it was to go to school in the 1940s and 50s, why WAMC's own Alan Shartok says that his college was free back then. What can we do as a society to bring the cost of college back down? And that is, as Frank Zappa would say, the crux of the biscuit right there. How do you bring the cost down?
Well, I think in many ways, I mean, I think we do the best we can to keep our tuition rates reasonable at SUNY. You know, they're not spiking. They're not, you know, we have a very rational approach to it. However, the cost of other types of services to students are what they are. You know, it costs a certain amount to, you know, heat the dorms, to provide food, all of those things. So one of the things that I would say in general is, you make the decision based on what you can afford, you know, based on, and kind of getting back to what Jerry said. And this is really one of the things that I think is really important is that, you know, there's so many things we can't control as an individual going into this. But what I can say is I can control whether I choose to live in a very expensive dorm or off campus in an expensive housing situation versus another type of arrangement. The other thing I would say is we are also looking at other opportunities to help students with costs like our open educational with our textbooks. So, you know, we have textbooks that are digital. We have a lot of initiatives moving in that direction. And those are all things that are taken into consideration when a student is approaching a decision about student loan borrowing. How much do I need for housing? Well, where do I have to live?
Right.
You know, what is my choice of transportation? You know, if I live on Long Island and I go to school in Buffalo, do I fly home or do I take a train or do I try to carpool? All of those go into the decision just as it would be. Do I buy a used textbook, get one digital, etc.
Okay. Let's go to Peter in Brooklyn. Peter, you're on.
Yeah. Hi. How are you today? So my wife and I have a 17-year-old son. He's currently choosing between, he's in the home stretch of choosing between a SUNY school and going to a state school in Colorado. The tuitions are actually very similar. My wife and I are career changers and both have gone into public education. We're both special educators, but she's been in the field 10 years. I've been in the field 5 years. So our salaries are just now above the point where we qualify for the Excelsior Scholarship. And on paper, a New York City public school teacher, compared to the rest of the country, we look okay, but it doesn't take into consideration our day-to-day cost of living.
Right.
And we also have student loans of our own that we're paying off. And so this idea of trying to make this happen is a very daunting one.
Yeah. Anybody?
Trying to...
Oh, I would say, you know, and I think obviously this is something that I would say go to SUNY because
well, too SUNY people here, right. So you're not don't have an unbiased crowd.
Yeah, Elizabeth how about and that? I recommend SUNY highly. No, we would definitely say though. I think even just making a decision about whether to go out of state or in state, keeping in mind again the other costs to. You know, what will it cost for transportation to come back and forth? Will that limit the ability for the student to come home? Will that impact the amount that they have to borrow? Those are all things that you would take into consideration, obviously, in addition to the academic piece, which is so huge. But given what we have to offer at SUNY, I would say in most of those cases, SUNY will come up on top.
So you're pretty much pro SUNY then on this.
You got that, right? I'm pro SUNY.
But I think it does sort of highlight the fact that it's people who are sort of in this middle to upper middle income bracket who are, you know, maybe they're not suffering the most because they're doing relatively well off to begin with, but who particularly get squeezed because you start to make above a certain amount and the financial aid drops off very quickly and even the in-state option quickly becomes very expensive.
Yeah. Jerry.
One piece that sometimes gets overlooked is the number of high school AP credits or other credits that could transfer in where you might be able to condense that four-year period to 3.5 years.
Yeah.
So if one institution is accepting all of them and one is not, that could weigh as a possible factor.
Although often they won't tell you in advance.
Let's go to Lila in Adams. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know if you can comment on this situation, but my son is in medical school. And he had to repeat his first year. He didn't pass the second semester of his first year, but had to repeat the entire year and pay for the entire year again. And he is passing everything, but as he just told me in a text, he's what he called approaching the red line, which is, you know, he's working at this all the time. English is his second language, and this is just a big hurdle, you know, for him. So my concern is that he will squeak by this year, borrow another big chunk of change for next year, and then not pass next year. As it stands, he has about $100,000 in debt, and there's the potential that he would be in that much debt or even in more debt and not leave with a degree.
Right.
Well, my suggestion would be for him to continue to study hard, but to start to look at alternatives maybe in the medical field as a backup, a master's degree or something. Hopefully these loans are federal. Because if they're federal, then he'll allow some different possibilities on income-driven repayments. And if he practices medicine, there could be, whether it's as a physician or otherwise, there could be debt forgiveness relative to where he practices medicine. But also there's something called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Provision, which may or may not be in place by the time he gets there, but it's worth examining. So this is a tough situation because if he doesn't finish, this is kind of what we talked about earlier. Some of the folks that struggle with loans are when they don't finish. They don't finish school, but still have loans that represent that time in school.
All right, Jerry in Chatham, Jerry.
Okay, Ray wasn't being cynical. I think he was being realistic. You know, I saw this every day as a high school teacher who taught of all things economics. Kids going off to college be like, "Why are you doing that?" You know. But here we have, and Ray also said, maybe it's time to rethink this whole thing. Consider this. We have colleges who want to grow and have more students. We want banks who want to lend money. We want parents who want their kids to go to college and politicians who cater to this thought that everybody should go to college. And here's what we get. 36% of the kids finish within 4 years. 60%, only 60%, after 6 years. So 40% don't even get a degree, can't pay back the money. As easy as the other kids. 11% default rates. Ray, you're right. There's something wrong with this picture. And consider that woman. How does this happen? $169,000 in debt she's going to be paying out of her Social Security, of course?
I don't know.
Is that even... what kind of system allows that?
Wow.
too many kids go to college.
Well, why don't we put this one to Elizabeth Pop Berman? She'll answer that question for you.
Well, no, yeah, that's an easy
go ahead.
One, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's hard to view this outside of the context of the economy more generally, and that we've we sort of find ourselves in a situation where it's true that you really do need a college degree in order to, not without exceptions, but on average, you know, it takes a college degree in order to sort of secure a middle class lifestyle, and even then, it's not a guarantee.
No, you don't. You can go into the trade.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And perhaps there's more people that we should make that an option for. But I think there's the set of people that you're talking about is the people who are starting and not finishing and find themselves in debt. And another thing that I think is on the table that's worth at least thinking about is how can we make sure that there are low risk options that people who are not really, you know, maybe shouldn't be in college full time yet can try and commit to. So, you know, and I think as we've had sort of tuition rate increases at the community college level, too, as well, that used to be something where tuition was very, very low and people could do that without really taking
on
debt.
Give it a try. Test the waters.
Yeah. Increasingly, they're taking on debt for that, too. And that's a real problem.
All right. Let's quickly go over to Pat in New Hartford, New York. Pat, you have about a minute here.
Yeah, well, you've addressed some of my questions, but what I wanted to say is that I do think, you know, the main challenge, and I've worked in private higher education for 30 of my 35 years. I did work at a public institution in Connecticut, and I just feel that families, you know, it's kind of like smoking. People know it's there. They know there are risks. They know there are, you know, side effects, and you can tell them that until you're blue in the face, but they're still going to smoke. With higher education, you could talk to families of children in elementary school. You got to start planning. You got to start saving. And they're not doing it. And what we're seeing, you know, in the junior and senior year is families coming to us saying, I can't afford to be here, but my son wants to come here or my daughter wants to come here. So we're not really given, we're not putting enough emphasis on the early part of the process. I do think that both the private sector and the public sector are trying things to make higher ed affordable. I do think that what we might call market corrections, we're starting to see more schools close because they're not, you know, in good financial shape. So I think there's going to be maybe fewer choices for students. And then I think the idea, and again, I work at a private college, I think that the community college approach really should be one of the primary approaches for many, many of the families that we see, both public and private. And I think that that's something that as a higher ed community, we need to do a better job of promoting.
All right, Pat, thank you very much. We're almost out of time here. Let's go to a closing statement. You have about 20 seconds, Patty Thompson. Anything we didn't cover that you want to mention?
Well, you know, I just wanted to just quickly say, you know, don't be afraid of student loans. Don't be afraid to borrow, but make sure that you're educated. Go to the tools that are available to you. SUNY.edu, as well as all of our campus websites, have a plethora of information. And our campus folks are always available to answer questions, even if you're not going to SUNY. You know, we want to be a resource, so we're available to you.
Elizabeth Pop Berman.
I would say be very clear on whether the loans you're taking out are federal loans or private loans, because that's going to make a big difference in the long run.
Jerry Englert.
I would say remove the emotion from the process and try to treat this as a consumer finance purchase.
Wow, you sound like a banker. Good for you. Hey, well, thank you all for being here today. Support comes from the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art, Amherst, Massachusetts, presenting Out of the Box. The graphic novel Comes of Age, featuring 10 coming-of-age novels, now through May 26th, carlemuseum.org. Interim Healthcare, for 49 years helping people remain at home, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, interimhealthcare.com. And Nine Pin Cider Works, Albany, featuring hard cider made from local apples, now serving pizza, light fare, beer, wine, and spirits in tasting room, open Tuesday through Sunday, ninepincider.com. Well, thanks again to Patty Thompson, Elizabeth Pop Berman, and Jerry Englert for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. We did the best we could. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who also did the best he could. Your phones are answered by Carol Lapani today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we go from a very, very dry topic to one that's very dirty? The Gardener's Return to help your yards get in tip-top shape. Right now, stand by for 51%.